Change happens. How we respond to change can make or break us and our careers. Join us for an intimate insight into how influential and authentic people lead through change. The good, the bad, and everything in between. Because whether we like it or not, change happens.
Hi, I'm Janelle McMaster, and welcome to the Change Happens podcast. Conversations with influential leaders on leading through change and the lessons learned along the way. Today, I'm joined by Australian rower and two-time Olympian Jessica Morrison, who represented Australia at the Tokyo 2020 Olympics and won gold in the women's Coxless 4 event. Jess also happens to work at EY, so she balances her sport with work commitments in EY's People Advisory Services practice, where she helps businesses integrate the people agenda within their business strategy and design. Now, in this episode, we're going to learn so much more about Jess's story, what it's like to be an elite athlete, and what the lessons are in there for us. Now, of course, being a dual Olympian is something that most of us can't lay claim to, but dealing with changing conditions, managing pressures, finding the right balance, being told we can't do something are definitely experiences most of us have had plenty of exposure to. So I'm looking forward to exploring this and much more with Jess. Jess, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm very excited to have you here. Now, huge congratulations on your recent accomplishments at the Games.
Thank you. It was an amazing experience, and obviously thrilled to actually get there in the end after much speculation whether it was going to happen or not. But, you know, I felt like we used the extra year of training to our advantage and, you know, stoked to come away with a win.
Oh, that's fantastic. Now, before we get into more discussion about Tokyo, let's go way back to the beginning. Keen to hear more about your upbringing and how it is that you found yourself in, you know, elite sports.
Yeah, I am the eldest of four, and I grew up in Melbourne, and I've got very active parents who always encourage us to do sport growing up, and competitive young siblings. And, you know, I started off trying a bunch of different sports in mm-hmm. school, and I was quite a fond skier, and we used to live at Falls Creek every winter. So I'd do homeschool for the term with my siblings up there, and we'd do race club. And you know, I was probably the worst of my siblings because I started a little bit later on, but, you know, all three of them represented Australia at a junior level, which was great.
Being the worst out of a bunch of siblings who are competing for Australia, it feels like you're probably not too shabby.
Well, yeah, I think I am definitely sort of maybe I shine in the water or on the water, but, like, you know, on the snow, that's sort of the claim to fame. But so I guess just having exposure at a young age to competitive sport and the opportunity to try a whole lot of different things growing up. And, you know, I chose swimming and I decided to take that on pretty seriously and sort of narrow my focus in on that in high school. And, you know, I never wanted to be a rower. Swimming was my dream, and mm-hmm. it always clashed with the rowing program at school because they trained at the same times. And so, you know, I dabbled in rowing a little bit at maybe year eight, but I opted out and decided to continue on with swimming and pursued that, you know, after school. And I took a scholarship at the Australian Institute of Sport in Canberra and moved up there and did uni at ANU and really wanted to sort of make it in swimming. And a couple of years into it, I got injured and had a shoulder reconstruction, and, you know, my swimming career was basically over. And I met Kim Brennan at the time, who also lived in Canberra and trained at the AIS, and she suggested I try rowing. You know, I was pretty upset with, you know, not being able to train properly with swimming. I was, you know, rehabbing away, had a dodgy shoulder. And she said, you know, you've got the right determination, you got the right build, you'd be great at it. Like, come on down to the shed and I'll introduce you to my coach. And, you know, off I went. And, you know, you could say the rest is history, but that was sort of at the end of 2013. And I tried that, and I made my first Olympic team 2.5 years later. So I guess
I'm going to have to stop you. That story, I mean, you're telling the story like just a bouncing ball, or this is naturally what will happen after one thing after another. That is not a normal story for the rest of it. We don't move from high levels of skiing to national swimming to then suddenly going, no, okay, I'll go to rowing and then win medals from there. So I want to take a step back for a minute. What was it like for you in 2013, when you had that injury? You know, you made your choice, you know, to have the options that you did. You're obviously an amazing athlete, but you made your choice and you said, I'm going to go be a swimmer. You had that injury and you realized you wouldn't be able to swim. What was that like, that realization?
I think like I'd always sort of told myself, like, you're only good at swimming. You've tried everything, you know, your whole, all your capabilities in sport is directed at swimming. That's what you've trained to do. So I had it in my head that like, if I didn't make it in swimming, I'd be sort of worthless as an athlete. And so to become injured and, you know, that was pretty devastating. And sometimes you can't help that when that happens, which is always really frustrating. But, you know, as a result of being injured and sort of unable to rehab, you know, in a really quick period of time, I lost my scholarship at the AIS. And, you know, sitting in a room with, you know, high performance directors sort of essentially saying I wasn't good enough, or they didn't think that I was good enough to make the Commonwealth Games team in 2014. And, you know, as a result, the Olympic Games wasn't looking good. So unfortunately, we're going to give your place to somebody else. And that was completely heartbreaking for me. You know, I felt like my dreams were just shattered and, you know, nobody believed in me. And I was willing to do whatever it took at the time to become fit enough so that, you know, when my shoulder came good, I sort of could jump back into the pool seamlessly. But, you know, setbacks happen to everybody and I just never expected it to happen to me. And, you know, I was completely shattered and it took me years to recover from that. Like I just...
Oh, bet. And so, how long exactly? So you mentioned that, I mean, these are big words, Jess, you know, felt worthless, not good enough, nobody believes in me. They are huge, huge issues to overcome. How long was it between sort of facing that kind of event and those feelings to then, and we're going to talk about Kim in a moment, but meeting Kim and making that decision, you know, you're going from the top of your chosen sport and swimming to possibly the bottom of rowing and trying to figure that out. How long was that period of time when you made that decision? And what was that like to sort of take the leap and go, yeah, I'll start again?
Yeah, it was, I think the idea that somebody was like, you know, choose rowing and you could beat the next Olympic Games. I was like, sure, sign me up. But, you know, what the process involved to get there, I didn't quite understand how patient you really needed to be and accepting the fact that you needed to be, you know, start from ground up. And, you know, I thought that I'd sort of move laterally over and just be at the same level I was rowing. So initially the idea sounded great, but the reality was really tough. And those are the times that doubt crept in when I was, you know, getting beaten by school kids at regattas, you know, training so hard, and they broke my rib and hurt my back a couple months into it. And, you know, that just made the process go even longer. So, you know, those are the times where you really think, oh, maybe I'll just go back to swimming. That's, you know, the window's still open there. And how long is this rowing going to take for me to get at an adequate level where I'll be, feel satisfied? So, you know, it probably took, you know, at least 2 years. Like even at the Olympic Games in Rio, I was fairly new to the sport and I still never really felt like, you know, I mastered it or I was actually, you know, able to be the world's best, which is what I've always wanted to be. So it's like even after I'd successfully transferred and sort of made an Olympic team, even then I still didn't feel like I truly like belonged in the sport. Like I was so new to it. And, you know, when I started swimming, I was, you know, 8 years old and that's been my home and my family for such a long period of time. So, you know, it took years and eventually got there, but it's such a weird transition to make. Like, you know, when you're sort of at your low 20s, when, you know, a lot of my friends had their life set up for them and they were on really sure path to whatever it was that they were wanting to be successful in. And here I was still trying to figure out what sport I'm good at. And
it's incredible. Now tell me more about Kim and when she came into your life and what it was that, you know, how did she convince you to make that leap?
I first met Kim at the end of 2012, once she'd got back from the London Olympic Games. I'd knew her from back in the day when I was in school. And I think, you know, I was sports captain at school and she presented at like a girls sport Victoria dinner and I was like, wow, like you're my idol. I want to be like you. And then here I was all those years later at the AIS and we were at the altitude house just on a week of training up in there and she was there and I was there and Scott Brennan was also there and it was just the three of us. And that's when I first met her. You know, she'd got back from the games and was training for her third Olympic cycle. And I think that's sort of where we really got to know each other at a personal level. And so, you know, and then from time to time I'd see her, you know, at the dining hall or in the gym or just passing by, you know, on campus. And, you know, when I was injured in 2013, you know, she'd see me sort of walk around pretty upset. And, you know, not long after I had that meeting where I'd lost my scholarship, I ran into her again and, you know, told her the news, and she kind of was my savior in a way. Like, she was like, oh, you know, your sporting career's not over. Like, why don't you try rowing? Like, you know, welcomed me with open arms into that community and that family. And
it really speaks to the power of mentoring and, you know, being taken under someone's wing and feeling that someone has your best interests at heart, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, just recognizing a few key attributes that I had, like, you know, just willing to sort of go above and beyond. You know, when I met her in the Altitude House the year prior to that, my coach hadn't asked me to go there. I'd asked myself if I can do a week, you know, in that Altitude House and just get the training benefits of it. And I think she admired that I sort of just went out on my own and wanted to sort of just go that extra few
yards. Just on that, actually, I'm really struck by this ability for people to be so excellent at so many things. Kim Brennan, she also suffered an injury. She changed to rowing from hurdling, then became a 16-time national champion, 2-time world champion, 3-time Olympian, Olympic gold medalist herself. She was a qualified lawyer, now a partner in tech consulting at EY. Like, that story as well is just unbelievable. You and Kim are the kind of people that make the rest of us ask ourselves, bloody hell, what are we doing with our lives? Now, I can either conclude that rowing is a very easy sport to win medals in, looking at you two, or you two are modern day miracles. But picking up on your point then, she saw some attribute. Perhaps there's some underlying attributes and disciplines that you both have that make your success transferable in different contexts. There's an expression, if you master that discipline, you master them all. What would you say to that? Is that what you think? And what are those underlying attributes and disciplines, do you think?
Yeah, I think, you know, when you do say, draw the parallels between me and Kim, I'm like, oh God, am I just following my whole life in the footsteps of Kim, like off to rowing and off to EY? And
there could be worse
and
things.
Who knows what's next? But I think, like, you know, Kim trained so hard and I aspired to be like her for so long. And, you know, if I had a huge amount of respect for her. So when I, you know, have a lot of respect for someone and they come and give you advice, I generally tend to follow it. And so felt like what she said to me and her belief in me really meant a lot. Personally, I kind of set no limits for myself. I think, you know, when I'm thinking about the key attributes to be successful in lots of different areas, like, I just feel like the sky's the limit. And I've always sort of had this deep sense of, you know, am I good enough? When will I be good enough? Like, was that performance good enough? Like, nothing's ever good enough, you know?
It must be exhausting though, Jess, to carry that.
It is exhausting, but it's kind of what pushes me to keep striving for more. Like, you know, I think, like, when will I ever be satisfied? Like, when I crossed the finish line in the gold medal position at the Olympics, I was like immediately like, oh God, we didn't win by enough. Or, you know,
really?
That was a real.
Is that what you thought?
I was like,
oh,
wanted
my God,
to win
take
by more.
The win.
And then I was like, wow, we could have done X, Y, Z in the middle of the race. Maybe that would have, like, got us in front a little bit more. I'm just, like, so immediately critical of myself and my performances. And, you know, sometimes it's a bad thing. I have to sort of, coaches always say, you know, take a step back, Jess, and just
Do you manage that? I mean, I can see how you use it to drive you, which is phenomenal. But I can imagine that there must be those tipping points where it goes the other way. What do you do then when it overtakes you and you feel a bit more crushed by the am I good enough questions?
I'm not sure. I think you know, sometimes I'm, you know, striving to win all the time to be the best that I can be, and that's a great feeling when that happens. But when I don't win, you know, that the magnitude of that loss is maybe greater. So It's a weird, like, psychology at play there. When you're so hard on yourself, you know, you want to be the best, you want to win by a lot, you're never sure when you're going to be satisfied. And then when you do achieve something that's pretty good, yeah, you feel great. But the magnitude of that is maybe not as great as the loss when I don't win. So it's trying to stay out of that domain, I guess. And I'm not sure if it's deep-rooted from, you know, my transition from swimming and being told I wasn't good enough. Like, am I on this mission to just be good enough at something? Like, when will I be good enough? I think maybe there's a link there, and I'm not sure when I'll sort of truly feel satisfied with what I do, but, you know, I keep striving and I keep going out and experimenting and taking on lots of different challenges.
Mm. It's such an important thing. You know, I've always thought that anyone's strength overused can become their Achilles heel. You know, you're clearly a massive driver, and that is your strength. That is your, you know, superpower that allows you to move forward. But so important. At least you're aware of the implications, the shadow of that attribute and how that can cast on yourself and others. So maybe we're all works in progress, Jess. So definitely one to keep working on and hoping that you take care of yourself and are kind to yourself. You're an incredible athlete and human. So if I say nothing else on this podcast, I really want you to know that I think you're an amazing, amazing individual. So please do know that you are plenty good enough, my friend.
Thanks, Janelle.
Counselling session over. But I'd like to, you know, just recognising that, you know, we've talked about this transition from swimming to rowing. The other remarkable thing about that is you've transitioned from a solo sport of swimming where it really is all down to you, something that you have full control over. And we've talked about, you know, how much of a driver you are. So you can fully control how you perform in the pool. Then you moved over to a team sport of rowing, where obviously there's at least one other, if not three others, that you're working with and depending on. What was that transition like? And what did you learn about yourself in relation to teaming?
Great question. I reflect on this a lot. I think it took me a while to really understand like the importance of team and what that meant. Like I was always such a self-motivated, self-driven person. I always tended to do the individual sports in school, you know, skiing, athletics, swimming. I never really did any team sports, and I really liked to have complete control of the outcome of a race or for a result. And so when I moved over to rowing, you know, the biggest challenge was, you know, I'm a bit of an introvert. Like you've got to talk a lot in the boat. Like somebody has to call, like whatever boat you're in, you've got to learn to work with people. You've got to communicate in a way that narrows everybody's focus to one thing and to keep everybody's head in the boat. And so just sort of learning to communicate with people was the first challenge. And then learning how to use people to get the best out of your boat was sort of the second challenge, and how to motivate people, like what's their competitive edge. I think how you measure a good rower is often how adaptable you are and how well you work with people. And, you know, that's a huge work in practice. Like it's not something that, you know, you can just get that overnight, or you can just rock up to a training session, and you've got to earn people's trust, and you've got to demonstrate an ability to really understand people. So, you know, my journey with rowing, I started off in the women's eight at Rio. You know, I was sort of 12.5% of that boat. And so, you know, I had a small impact on the outcome of that boat. And, you know, that was a weird transition to go literally from swimming one event to hopping into a boat where I'm one out of nine, including the coxswain. And, you know, really wanted to make sure that I could feel like I contribute, and finding out how you contribute in a team situation's hard to navigate as well. And as I sort of matured over the years and became sort of more of an integral player of the team and physically got better and technically got better, I was able to sort of really uncover those things that, you know, really matter in working in the team. And I think like you got to make sure everybody feels like an equal, and you've got to make sure everybody feels heard. So when we go out for a rowing session, if we're in an eight or a pair or a four, it doesn't matter what it is, you stop, you know, when we turn around or whenever we do stop, which is, you know, it is often, and you ask, you know, what did you think of that piece, or what can we do better? Like making sure you ask some people, give them a chance to feel heard, to contribute to problem solving, because you're constantly problem solving in rowing. You're figuring out, you know, if the platform's off or if the boat's not quite straight, like, you know, trying to figure out what we've got to do technically to fix that. And everybody has a different perspective.
It's fascinating. Jess, you know, you're talking about so many big things around communication, around trust, around getting the best out of others, around problem solving. Did you just figure this out as you went along, or did you actually do some, you know, team leadership training? How did that just evolve? Did it just evolve, or did you go through some formal training on it as well?
There's definitely not a rule book for, like, you know, how to be a good rower or how to be a good teammate. You kind of have to figure it out, like, you know, on the job. I am sort of like, as I said before, a bit of an introvert, you know, not as outspoken as some of my other teammates, but I do consider myself a bit of a hard worker and I sort of lead by example. And my time at the National Training Center, I was awarded a leadership award in recognition for, my leadership contribution to the group. And then, one day my coach said, Jess, that award meant something. You're a leader, whether you see it or not. What you say matters. Speak up more, after sessions, and speak up more in the boat, And so I started to do that a little bit more. And
you
then
found
I
your voice.
It's amazing. Like, got a bit of confidence. People did start listening to what I had to say. Just kind of took off from there, but gave a bit of a nudge from my coach and a bit of recognition from the wider group sort of gave me the confidence to sort of to use my voice and to help other people.
Let's turn to Rio. You were, if I understand it correctly, advised that you were going to be included in the Olympics in Rio only a fortnight before you were to race. What was that like? It feels like that must be a bit of a scurry. And what was that like compared to the period of time of Tokyo? So the two totally different circumstances, one's much shorter, there's uncertainty in there, training would have been different. Tell me about Rio first and what it was like to find out that you're going to be in.
Exactly. They're two totally different Olympic experiences. And compared to the normal Olympic Games, both of them are fairly unconventional.
Okay.
Disrupted training times before. So when I was selected into the women's eight in 2016, the boat hadn't yet qualified for the Olympics. So a couple months after I was selected into the boat, we were afforded the opportunity to go to final qualification regatta. We needed to come top two and we placed third. So we missed out by one spot. Another devastating moment in my career. And I was like, oh God, maybe the Olympics just isn't for me, so everyone parted ways and went home. Didn't row together because all the girls were from different parts of the country.
Right.
And it's sort of in the background while all this is happening, the World Anti-Doping Agency is sort of looking into primarily Russia. Some of those people were in rowing and some of the girls were sort of getting their hopes up that maybe the Russians would be withdrawn. And I was like, God, that's never going to happen. Like all of a sudden sort of started bubbling away more. And I think a lot of the athletics team got withdrawn. So we're like, oh, wow, this is really real. Like we were all sort of called onto a conference call with our CEO. This was about 3 weeks before the opening ceremony. And he kind of basically said, girls, Russia's been withdrawn because we placed third at FQR. We're now the next eligible place for the Olympics. Is this something you would want to do? And of course, we all said yes. And then he's like, right, he's like, right, we'll pack your bags. You're off to Rio. And I was in the kitchen with my parents, just had dinner. And I was like on the call and I turned to them, gave them the thumbs up. And I was like, I'm going to the Olympic Games.
Oh my gosh.
Like, one of the girls was in Dubai and all of us were everywhere. And we were like, right, okay, everyone get on a flight, come to Melbourne. We're going to have our 3-week campaign in Melbourne and just see what we can do. So a fantastic opportunity, I guess, a big stance on, clean sport. And so it was great to go, but obviously we weren't, given the same preparation that our competitors were given. And, I think we sort of set out and maybe thought we could make the final and that would be a good result. So compare that with the Tokyo Olympic Games, much more time in the sport. I'm way more experienced and I was out to win a gold medal, not just be a competitor, which I was in Rio. The Tokyo Games comes along and again, didn't, see that it would be delayed, another curveball thrown at us. In March of 2020, we'd just done our national selections. I was selected into the pair. And literally 2 weeks later, an announcement came out that the Olympics were postponed a year. And
what was that like?
Well, it was a tough pill to swallow because it was like you go from being at a real high, like I've just been selected on the team, I'm really fit, and it's like, oh, now we're shifting the goalposts a whole year. Stay motivated, stay fit, and we're going to do a whole another round of selections. And by the way, we're going into lockdown for probably 6 months, so you guys have to leave and go home and train out of your garage. It was like a lot to process in a really short period of time. I think the biggest challenge at the time was flipping that setback into opportunity and realizing I'm not going to dwell on the fact that the games are next year, but I'm going to get excited about the opportunity that I can get a lot better in a year's time. How much gains can I make? I could present at an Olympic Games a lot better next year than I would this year. So,
well, it seems like you did turn that into an opportunity, but how challenging was that to turn that setback into an opportunity? How challenging was it to train out of your garage and not with others?
I think everybody handled it differently. I was lucky that, you know, I was working at EY at the time on a part-time basis, so I had something to fall back to. So it was like, okay, now rowing's not going to be the major focus for a period of time. I'm going to throw myself into work. So I immediately had something to shift my focus to feel like I could do a good job and add value. Some of the other girls sort of had postponed uni or, you know, weren't even doing uni or working. So, you know, to sort of be left with your thoughts for 24 hours a day was potentially a bit more challenging. But I think, you know, still trying to stay really tight as a team was really important. You know, our coaches did a really good job of still keeping it really big picture, set goals for us that are sort of short term and, okay, what are we going to do this month? What are we going to do next month? Sort of real bite-sized things just to focus on rather than just think about, oh, the extra year the entire time. But for me, just having something to fall back onto immediately really helped with that.
Jess, you talked about your coaches working with you and the team, trying to keep you all connected and working together during lockdown. I feel a high level of relatability to that, and people listening will certainly feel a relatability with that given our lockdown and the challenge in teams feeling connected and engaged and motivated whilst separated for such a long period of time. How did your coaches help? How did you and your teams maintain that connection whilst in lockdown?
Yeah, I think like while our team is so successful is because like we've got a very strong culture. We've got a culture that we're, you know, hugely grateful for what we have, and we're very big picture focused. And the coaches tried to sort of keep that going, keep the momentum going. Like we had a group chat that we were typing in every day and posting our like fun photos, just try to make it fun but stay connected. We did sessions over Zoom, still very much big picture focus even when we were apart, and we tried as best as we could to sort of do sessions over Zoom. But, you know, lots of reminders of what we're doing this for and, you know, why we're here and everything like that. So I think like in any kind of uncertainty or murky waters, just the ability to sort of hold the wheel if you're kind of like steering a ship and not overcorrect. And the coaches did a great job at kind of like holding the wheel and keeping us on track, keeping our heads in the game, and the daily reminders of, you know, what we're doing this for, why we're doing it was really important.
No, it's fantastic. And just, you know, I'm just reflecting on this, you know, the setbacks and the, you know, will we, won't we, yes, we have, no, we won't. Not. And I think about many of us, you know, when we look at the Olympic finals, we see those medal winning moments, but there's so many stages of achievements and milestones along the way, whether, you know, accepted into a national training facility, getting sponsors, making the Olympic team, getting onto a flight, getting off a flight, stepping onto the Olympic Village. Yet you come across as a very measured person. How do you manage those ups and downs and the highs and lows? Do you allow yourself to feel those things, or do you stay as steady as you present, at least to me right now, through that?
I think because I've experienced like what I felt like was my real low and, you know, my swimming career ending, I never want to feel a huge magnitude of a high or a low. And so I do tend to stay quite steady. And when I do win a race, it's like, oh, that's great. But then I'm maybe my critiquing immediately is a way of trying to not let the high get too high.
Yeah,
and then
temper it. And then,
you know, the reverse for the low, just trying to just keep the magnitudes as small as possible. I think that's just the way that I like to live my life. I think many years ago, one of the athletes on our team, Josh Dunkley-Smith, who I look up to a lot, gave some advice to me that sort of stuck with me. And he said, if you're not happy before the medal, you won't be happy after the medal. And that, you know, it's something that we all strive towards as elite athletes. Yes, we want to go to the games and, you know, the ultimate success is an Olympic gold medal, but it certainly doesn't change who you are, or it doesn't change the rest of your life. And if you're not happy beforehand, you're not going to be happy afterwards necessarily. So I've always sort of thought in the back of my mind, like, I'm just going to live my life. I'm going to challenge myself in ways. I'm going to try to be the best that I'm going to be. And, you know, if I do all that right, the gold medal will take care of itself. But it's certainly not something that I'm going to feel like if I attain this one thing, it's going to be life-changing and make me a happy person.
You're not attaching your happiness and all of your identity to that. I think it's a great piece of advice. I think it's too precarious to tether your happiness to something that's as tenuous as getting a gold medal and it's fleeting.
Yeah, definitely. So I think just try to be, or I at least just try to be as flatlined as possible. And, you know, maybe that's inappropriate for times that you do well and you want to be celebrate a lot, but it's just, I guess it's just the way I am. And
what about that you've got three others that were celebrating that gold with you in that with that boat? Were all of them as tempered as you are? Or were they lifting you up because you've got a few more people who are willing to just ride that big high?
Yeah, we all had different reactions. I think so Annabelle and myself, who were stern pair of the four, we also were competing in the pair. So we were racing two events. And the typhoon at the time sort of reshuffled the days of racing. So, you know, the semi-final of the pair, which was supposed to happen the day before our four final, actually got changed to 2 hours after the four final. So as soon as I crossed the line, it was like, yes, job one done. Now I've got to think about my race in 2 hours' time. That's a semi-final. So I think that's kind of what didn't allow me to feel that high as being too high. Rosie, who sat behind me, she was, you know, crying. She just had that wave of emotion. She was ecstatic and really emotional. And Lucy, you know, celebrating, hands in the air, just, you know, and I turned around and I was like, did we win? I didn't even know if we won. And then I was like, oh, great, we won. That's great. Okay, you know, celebrate for 5 minutes and then off to my next thing. So everyone kind of, we all have very different personalities and as a result, you know, have different reactions to things. So I think, you know, we're all very respectful of how we operate, and if I'm sure that they wouldn't have minded if I wasn't, you know, hands in the air and crying and over the moon like they were.
Hey, Jess, do you have a gold medal near you?
I do.
If you don't mind, can you just hold that in your hands?
Yeah.
And tell me, looking at that gold medal.
Yeah, I've got it. I'm holding it now.
And all that's gone into that, what does it feel like?
Oh, it feels great, honestly. And it's just like it's a medal for so many people, not just a medal for me. Like, you know, I wish I sort of had the chance to say that, but you know, when you are standing on the dais and you have this and you're looking into an empty crowd, like it's the time that you think about, oh, everyone that's helped you get there. And you know, some of the proudest moments over the past month has been reaching out to the people that have been so impactful in my life and letting them know, oh, you know, you made a huge impact on me, and that's, you know, that helped me achieve a gold medal, you know, whether it's a sports teacher or, you know, a swimming coach when I was 15 or something like that. So, you know, the medal is so heavy, and maybe that's symbolic of the fact that there are so many people that this is for, not just me.
Oh, that's so good. Well, rest assured, as you know, we were all watching you and got some great photos of the firm stopping to watch you race. It was amazing. Now, speaking of the firm, another big change in your life was your decision to join EY. I imagine that would have been quite a foreign world. I mean, it's a different, like, I you know, I've grown up in consulting, but you know, I can recognize it's a whole different language in its own world unto itself. Tell me about what that change was like for you.
That was a pretty big change, you know, for someone that had spent all of their life like wearing athletic gear and then, you know, taking up a job to go into an office and wear business attire. I was like, I don't even own any of that.
Don't need to anymore. We're all at home.
Exactly. That was the first kind of challenge. And I remember when I accepted the job at EY, my mum organized a professional stylist appointment at David Jones. And I went in there and just went and bought some work clothes because, you know, I owned nothing. So that was the first sort of foreign world sort of insight. And then, you know, going into the offices and just feeling like you have to be this polished person that's, you know, wearing really nice clothes and having your makeup on and your hair done really nicely. Like I never wear makeup. So that was another weird thing. And being this like professional, and I didn't really know who I was as a professional. You know, I've got the credentials. I've just done a Bachelor of Economics and I've done an MBA and I pursued consulting because typically that's the best avenue out of an MBA and the best skill set that I had. But then again, I was just like, I've never been here. I don't know who I am as a professional. Like, where do I, you know, can I joke about things that I, you know, normally joke about with people, or, you know, is it not appropriate? So I think that was a bit of a shift, you know, and I didn't even know what a calendar invite was. So it's just kind of just learning the way. And I think I definitely sent some wrong calendar invites, mucked up the time zones. And
we've all done that, Jess, in or out of the boat. I swear we've all done it.
It's just feeling like you're really in your comfort zone, which was sport for me. You know, I'd I know how to do well at that, and then how do I do well in the business world? Like, you know, I've got the brains for it, but like, I don't know how to talk to people. I don't know how to write an email. I don't know how to wear proper clothes. Like, you know, that was my memory of the transition to EY.
What do you think, were you surprised by any things that translated really easily from your sporting world across to the business world? Were you like, yes, now that I've got the clothes on and I've, you know, figured out how to set up a calendar invite, actually there's a lot of other stuff that I already have that's highly transferable. What would they be?
I think what I was talking to you before about teamwork and how to work in a team and ensuring people feel like equals and feel like they're heard, I felt like I was able to handle myself quite well in team meetings. And although I found client meetings at first pretty scary, just the ability to sit back and make sure, you know, you hear the person talking and make sure they feel heard and understood and then start talking. It's just like a very simple skill like that I felt like I was really comfortable with. You know, obviously, you know, any task that I was given by a senior manager or a manager, it was a real transfer of trust. Like they were trusting that I was going to do this, you know, and turn it over at the time that we'd agreed. And that was a very familiar thing for me. It's like being asked to do a training session or something and sit on these watts for the ergo. And it's like, yep, I'll do that. That's what my role is. And you can trust me to do that. So I feel like any time like a task was given to me, I really knew what that meant. And it meant like that transfer of trust, because if I could deliver that on time and to a high quality, then that was really what it was about, with feeling like I could comfortably navigate my way around the office and do good work. So I think those are the kind of things that I felt initially that, you know, my experience in sport helped me with.
It's fantastic. And certainly one of the observations that I know in the past Kim has made of you is that you have a relentless quest to learn, even when no one's watching. What would you say to that? Would you agree with that? And how have you applied that in the business world as well?
Well, I'm definitely always keen to learn, as I am always keen to strive for more and try to be a better person and contribute more knowledge. You know, I had some spare time on my hands last year and I was like, you know, what do I do? I'll do a company director's course. It looks like on LinkedIn lots of people have done this. Maybe it'll help me one day. And, you know, my dad previously recommended me doing that one day and I was like, oh, I'll just do it and I'll learn about being a board director, obviously a fair way off being one of those people. But that's just an example of something that I was happily able to sign up to. I was so close to doing the same, to do a Pilates course, just because I'm interested in anatomy and I wanted to just learn about the human body a little bit more. Totally not, you know, relevant to EY, and I didn't really need that for sport, but, you know, I was definitely considering doing something like that. I think, you know, I just think of my brain as like a sponge and I just want to absorb as much as I can. And sometimes I'm like, oh, we're not here for that long on earth. Like, you know, I want to learn as much as I can. And I think that's just, I'm just definitely really hungry for knowledge and always just trying to see what I can do with what I know and how much more of an impact I can make with, you know,
that's amazing.
More things I can bring to the table.
I mean, last I checked, we all still have 24 hours in a day to work with. How do you manage all of those athletic responsibilities alongside your professional responsibilities, and you can whack in an AICD course when you've got a little dad, and, you know, all of these things? How do you manage time and energy probably?
I think I learnt how to manage time well when I was in school. I did IB, which is the International Baccalaureate diploma, and, you know, it required a lot more work than VCE and I really wanted to do it. And I remember my, you know, the head of IB at the time said, you know, Jess, do you want to do this over 3 years instead of 2 years? Because you're trying to manage your sporting commitments and, you know, I'm not sure if you'll be able to complete this to the standard that Lauristonian girls sort of achieve. And I was like, no, I can do it. Thank you, but no thanks. I think just the structure of school just taught me how to translate that structure into my life after school. So I was like training, you know, wake up at 4:30 every morning. Mum would take me to the pool. I'd do a training session and the bus would pick me up, take me to school. I'd work all day and then take the bus back to training and then come home and eat and study and go to bed. And, you know, doing that when I was really young just taught me the habit of like how to use every hour of your day and allocate it to something, whether it's sport or, you know, academics. And I guess I just continued on with that practice after school, and it's no different when I was working in EY. I just, you know, would train in the morning, set very clear boundaries about when you're on and off for work, and I guess just using the momentum of having a lot on your plate kind of helps me be really efficient and do a good job at things, if that makes sense.
It does. Well, yes. I am thinking through my own diary at the minute going, well, there's a bit of time in there. What's downtime for you look like? Tell me you have
some. Honestly, I love a Sunday. I just sit on the couch at home with my sister and we watch Keeping Up with the Kardashians. Like, I do love some trash TV, some reality TV.
Me too.
That's the ultimate downtime. But otherwise, I do love to be in the outdoors. I love hiking, you know, I love being up in the snow, skiing. I kind of love, you know, being off my phone. I'm not really on social media, so I don't find that I get dragged into that hole too often of
that's gonna
of the scrolling.
Yeah.
But yeah, I do love just lounging on the couch and watching some reality TV. And if I'm not doing that, then being outside is equally amazing.
The last three fast questions on change to finish the podcast.
Tell me, what are you reading, watching, or listening to right now? Perhaps it's the Kardashians, but tell me, what's on your reading, watch, or listening list?
I'm reading The Omnivore's Dilemma by Michael Pollan. He's one of my favorite journalists, and it's quite an old book. It's maybe 15 years old, and I guess it's kind of about the intersection between learning about food we're eating, where the foods come from, and the impact it has on the planet. So that's really cool. I'm watching season 5 of Money Heist on Netflix. That's definitely my favorite show.
At the top of the list.
And what do I listen to? I'm listening to a podcast called
Change Happens.
Park Predators. It's probably like a little bit scary given that I've just been to a whole bunch of national parks, but it's about, you know, crime and, you know, all of the crime that's happened over the years in national parks.
I do have a real penchant for true crime podcasts as well, actually. What is your superpower? I feel like we've been talking for a long time about your superpowers, but this could be something that's additive to the world, Jess, or a useless party trick.
Oh, superpower.
I think we've observed it in action. You can turn your hand to any sport and achieve gold.
I can make sourdough bread, and I have my own sourdough starter that lives in the fridge, and I'm pretty competent in making bread. So I don't know if you'd really do that at a party, but that's
you do in lockdown. So it works. Yeah. It works. We'll take that. Now, if you were going to put a quote up on a billboard, what would it be?
Gee, I always love this quote. If the grass seems greener, it's probably AstroTurf. I don't know where
love
I heard that.
Love it. We'll take that one. Jess, I can't thank you enough for your time. I know you're actually, we didn't mention the fact that you're still in the US, slowly making your way back home, but I wish you all the very best. I want to thank you for sharing with us so many insights. You know, it's really your hunger for knowledge and your desire to have greater impacts in and on the world. Unbelievable. Your determination is unquestionable. But the other thing I hear in your story, Jess, is real humility. You know, you can be determined, but having the humility to start over, you know, when you face a setback and start at the bottom and work your way back up, the humility to move from being the single solo person in the pool who can win to being part of 9 in a boat, and realizing that you're 1/12th of the equation, but willing to do that. The power of role modeling and mentoring and your own quiet leadership where you lead by example. I've learned about the transferability of your teamwork skills and how you flip setbacks into opportunities. So much to take away from the chat, and massive thank you for your time.
Oh, thank you so much, Janelle. It was a pleasure talking to you. And I think just to sum up, it's kind of like for me, it's not necessarily about what you achieve. It's sort of how you're remembered, and, you know, bringing that back to humility. And it's not something that I'm very conscious of, but someone once said that to me, and it's always been sort of like how you carry yourself and how you treat people and what you say, and, you know, it leaves a huge mark on the world, potentially greater than what you sort of achieve, you know, medal-wise.
So important, and I'll absolutely take that one away with us as well. Thank you so much, Jess.
Thanks, Janelle.
The Change Happens podcast from EY, a conversation on leading through change. Discover more where you get your podcasts.